What's up? Another episode of Real Perfect Podcast. I'm your host, Ricardo Verendez, and we are back with another great episode. I know I always say that, but I've been very lucky to have a lot of great guests. So I guess that statement remains true. We do have another great guest, scientist, lecturer, author, Rupert Sheldrick. He's been on a lot of other really good podcasts, and he's had a lot of really interesting conversations on those shows. So I highly recommend you guys checking out him on the Joe Rogan podcast. It's a little bit of an older episode, but you guys can still find it online. He's been on London Real more recently. He's been on Russell Brand's Under the Skin podcast, so check that out. And he's also been on former guests of this show, Douglas Ruskoff, his podcast. He has a podcast called Team Human. He's been on there. So definitely check out those conversations. Really interesting. I love people like Rupert who pushes the boundaries on what we think we understand about consciousness and reality, and also the importance of spirituality and experiences and being connected with our surroundings and Mother Nature. I know it sounds all hippie and whatnot, but I think there's really something about our connection with nature and maybe a lack of it that I think is a huge issue with modern day and the way we live in cities and whatnot, and we're so disconnected from nature. So there's obviously tons of evidence that proves that walking on grass with no shoes and just being in the woods and getting fresh air and being in groups and having some type of community, how all this stuff can only improve your life and your you know, decreases anxiety, depression, and all that stuff, and your moods, and obviously the power of the sun. You know, for example, you know, when it's a sunny day, your mood's better, you have more energy, and when it's a cloudy day and you have a couple of days of rain, everybody just seems like they're in shittier moods, and I think there's something to it. So we talk about all that stuff and more. So enjoy the show. I won't hold you guys up too much. Remember that I am on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. You can look me up in all those platforms. Follow me, write me a message if you have any suggestions, or like a show, don't like a show, and actually if you don't like a show, keep that to yourself. Just share the positive stuff, and rate the show if you can on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you listen to the podcast. And I think that's it for now. So enjoy the conversation, and also check out his most recent book, Science and Spiritual Practices: Transformative Experiences and Their Effects on Our Bodies, Brains, and Health. And I'll see you on the next one. Peace. Yeah, yeah, no problem. But then let's jump right into it. I like to have I try to keep the conversation casual, so that's why I usually right when the call starts, I try to have the conversation just jump right into it, and that way I don't take up too much of the guests' time, and also it keeps the conversation casual. So yeah, and dinner time is very important, and I was born in not too far from you in Portugal, so in northern Portugal. So you know, growing up in a European family, dinner was really important, and I think
much later than in America.
We ate much later. It's funny, I still do that with my wife now. My wife, we have two kids. We have a three-year-old and a two-year-old, and we put them to bed first and then we have dinner. And first my wife, like, this is crazy because our kids sometimes don't go to bed at a reasonable time. Like, this means we're gonna have really late dinners on certain days. But I was trying to explain to her, I'm like, yeah, but it's very important for us to have that little bit of time where we pop open a bottle of wine, we appreciate our senses, we appreciate the smells and the taste of the foods and the wine, and we have that bonding time, because if not, you're so caught up with life, with you know, going to
absolutely well, we did exactly the same with our kids when they were young. Yes.
Yeah, it's very important to have that, because if not, then you get so caught up with the life priorities that everything else kind of becomes you know, basically put in the back burner and in regards to your relationship and you need that. I think it's a dinner can be kind of a sense of therapy. You know, when you look at, like, since the beginning of time, you know, there's been one thing that's been pretty constant for that was enjoyment before there was technology and all this other stuff that people use for entertainment now. Like, probably one of the most enjoyable times of the day was after everybody's done with all their chores and done with all their work, everybody gathered together around the fire and they ate together. And you talked, you communicated or whatnot. So it's probably deep rooted in our DNA to appreciate that and enjoy that. And I think today more than ever, we neglect our senses, you know, our smells and tastes. And
absolutely,
so,
yes.
So that's why I see, it's kind of seems like there's this a comeback with cigars, with younger people getting the cigars and bourbons and whiskeys and appreciating the simple things that, you know, things that you appreciate just for the craftsmanship of making it and the smells, the tastes and all that stuff. It's almost like the more we go into the digital world, the more we try to hold on to the analog world and some of the stuff that we appreciated then. So, you know, I'm pretty young. I'm 33 years old, but I've been, you know, my dad's a winemaker. He's been making wine, you know, his whole life, and my grandparents did it, and my great grandparents. And I didn't really get, you know, why go through all that work when you can just buy it, you know. But now, as I'm older, I see how it becomes this communal thing where the community comes together. You know, you guys all come, you know, the family comes together, everybody comes over, they help make the wine, they eat, they drink together, and it becomes a reason to get everybody together. And so I think we don't see enough of that. You know, we just, there's a lot we can learn from our tribal ancestors.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, but this is kind of some of the stuff that you talk about a little bit in your book. I think that there's, you know, there's a link between how today there's this increase in depression and anxiety and people being unhappy. And there's also this increase of people becoming less attached to our communities. We have a lack of community, especially in America. One thing that I see a lot of, you know, I even see with a lot of the immigrant friends that I have, where, you know, our foreigner parents come to this country to get financially ahead, but they get so caught up with that goal that they lose what made their culture, you know, important and fun and kept people together. And that was the having dinners together and making wine together and just playing cards together and communicating, having conversation. And I think that's kind of something that you see a lot. And probably capitalism has a little bit to blame for that. We get so caught up with this idea of, like, making money is always a good thing. And it should be top priority. And we, you know, Graham Hancock, I think it was him who I heard say once that one of the problems with modern society is that we judge somebody based on what type of car they drive and not how many rides they give him with that car. And it's kind of a simple quote to kind of understand that, yeah, we kind of, you know, we look at somebody who's financially successful and we envy that. But that, what are we envying? You know, to me, they have the same addiction as somebody who's addicted to alcohol or any other a drug or substance. Like, you're addicted to money. You never have enough of it, and it never satisfies you, and you constantly strive to get more and more. And you look at the symptoms, addiction to money and addiction to any other substance, I mean, the symptoms are the same. The only difference is that usually somebody who's addicted to drugs isn't financially successful, but somebody who's addicted to money is, because that means that you'll be very cutthroat and willing to do whatever it takes to get ahead. And unfortunately, we've created a system where we reward people who have those type of mentalities. You know, that's, I think I...
Yes, I agree. It's not good.
Yeah, not good at all. But I think there's definitely something to, you know, this is where I had a personal journey kind of very similar to yours, where I was raised a Catholic and then completely rebelled against that because similar to, you know, yourself, like, I'm constantly questioning things and wondering, like, why should I believe this? Where are the holes in this theory and whatnot? And then I kind of rebelled against it and realized, okay, well, this doesn't make any sense. And then I became, you know, a Richard Dawkins fan and, you know, and a lot of these atheists, I became a fan of theirs. And then after a while, I realized, like, okay, these guys have become as extreme as the extremists that they were supposedly fighting against. And you know, you talk a lot about dogmas and stuff like that. And I don't know if you've seen some of the recent debates or conversations that Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson has had, but I think they're interesting conversations because I think there's...
I did see those, actually, yes. I'm quite interested I was quite interested to see how Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson would get on together.
What did you think about them? What was your opinion on both sides? And do you have an opinion on some of the arguments they're making?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was more interested in the kind of style of interaction. I mean, they seem fairly respectful of each other, and they're both sort of fairly hard-hitting. What arguments have you in mind particularly? I mean, because they covered a lot of ground in two debates.
Well, I think I agree a lot with Jordan Peterson in regards to, you know, just Sam Harris very much. I think he doesn't catch himself the fact that he's constantly seeing things from his perspective, based on his upbringing and where, you know, and just basically his perspective, where he thinks there's an absolute truth, there's absolute laws, there's absolute, you know, like there's truth with a capital T, you know, and that there's some things are cut and dry, like where, and he also thinks that, you know, there's other ways of that religion is always bad. And I mean, obviously everybody has heard the things in the news with the Catholic Church and stuff like that. And you can blame a lot of wars on religion and stuff like that. But I think that you can remove religion and put any other type of ideology and use it as a way of manipulating people to do things or as a motivation to go to war.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. You know, well, I mean, atheism has the worst track record of anything, doesn't it? When you think about Stalin, Mao Zedong, and Pol Pot, you know, the most murderous, that was state atheism. You know, estimates vary, but tens of millions of people died by those people being so sure that they were right. And, you know, what Sam Harris does, I think, is he picks all the most negative aspects of religion and, you know, focuses on those and ignores all the positive aspects. And of course, if you take anything, any human invention, anything in the world, and focus only on the negative aspects, then you'll get a negative view of it. So it just seems to me extremely one-sided, and the fact that he seems so angry about religion suggests he's got some deep unresolved issues. I don't know what they are, but he could make his case much more effectively if he wasn't basically angry and so negative.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I've been, where, you know, I think similar to Sam Harris, I think a lot of people, and even Joe Rogan has a similar story where he was, you know, raised Catholic, and then I think you realize, okay, there's holes in you know, they told me this is the truth and we have all the answers, then you realize there's holes in their stories and they don't like when you question things, and then you end up bashing the whole thing. But I think that it's like any story, it's like listening to or reading poetry and getting something from it, right? It can be positive to your life in the same way. You know, I know born again Christians that you know, completely got their lives together. They were drug addicts, this and that, in and out of rehabs, and got their lives together because they believe that God gave them the strength to do so. Now, I tend to believe that they're giving the credit to some supernatural power that probably doesn't exist, but if they got their life together and they're better off because of it, if it gave them some type of internal energy to get through some life struggles, then who am I to say it's a bad thing? Does it matter if it exists or not, or if I believe it exists or not, as long as it's doing some positive? That's kind of the way I look at it.
Yes, well, I think, you know, I think we have to look at what effects things have, and that's why in my recent book, Science and Spiritual Practices, I'm looking at the actual evidence for these seven different spiritual practices, because they have measurable, scientifically testable effects, and on the whole, those effects are good. People benefit from doing these practices. A lot of them benefit whatever their belief system. For example, pilgrimage, which is undergoing a big revival in Europe at the moment. I'm a patron of the British Pilgrimage Trust, which is reopening the ancient footpath pilgrimage routes across England, and similar movements going on in Wales and Scotland and Ireland. We have some young men who run this who take guided pilgrimages, and people love going on these. And one of our slogans is, bring your own beliefs. It's not primarily about belief, it's about experience. And the same is true of the massive pilgrimage in Spain to Santiago de Compostela, the Camino. Now has about 300,000 people a year walking to Santiago. And many of them are atheists or agnostics or members of other religions. And it's certainly not all devout Catholics. And yet, most people who do it get a serious benefit from it. So I think that focusing on belief is actually a mistake. I think what we should focus on is experience, and that's exactly why I wrote this particular book.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and the other thing is, you know, just the power of the mind. You know, you look at something like the placebo effect. We know it exists, but we still have very little to no understanding on how it actually works. And, you know, we know that, like, mentally, when you feel like shit, your body feels, you know, low in energy and whatnot. And then mentally, when you feel good, your body feels good. And it's but yet people kind of take for granted the power of the mind. You know, it's that's where, like, these people like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and some of these new atheists, everything has to, you know, the thing about science is that nobody's dug in more graves than to old theories, you know, than science. Science has constantly should be reinventing itself and digging graves for theories and creating new theories as new evidence comes. But yet a lot of these new atheists seem so certain of things, you know, or, and there's so much that seems like it's spiritual mumbo jumbo, but if you can't explain it, and if there's some evidence that there's this unexplained thing, then who are we to kind of poo-poo it and then say that, you know, it's not a, you know, it's nothing or whatnot. And,
well,
you know,
I mean, it's more than just not poo-pooing it. I mean, a lot of spiritual practices have now been investigated scientifically, like meditation, which shows very clearly that there are benefits for most people who do them, you know, both physiologically, reducing blood pressure, stress hormone levels, affecting the brain in positive ways, and enabling those who do it to be less depressed, sleep better, have happier lives. All these are actually measurable benefits, and I think that it's clear that a lot of these practices can do a great deal of good. So it's not just subjective. And what the placebo effect shows us, really, is that the power of the mind and one's attitude and one's expectations can influence healing. And, you know, when people go to, say, on a pilgrimage to Lourdes in France, where there's this healing shrine, a healing spring, a lot of people claim to be healed there. I think they actually are. And then the critics say, well, it's just the placebo effect. They go there expecting to be healed, and they are healed. Well, my attitude is, call it what you like. The fact is, they go there on a pilgrimage for healing, and many of them are actually healed. So in that sense, it works, whatever explanation one likes to give to that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And that's the thing. There's so many things that we still don't understand. That's why your theory of morphic resonance is so interesting. And for people who are listening who don't quite understand what that theory is, could you give just a brief description on what morphic resonance is?
Yes, it's a memory principle in the universe. It's the idea that things resonate across time from the past to the present. Depending on their shape, form, or pattern, the word morphic means form. So it leads to a kind of collective memory in each species. So each individual draws on that collective memory and in turn contributes to it. It predicts, for example, that if rats learn a new trick in New York, then rats will learn the same thing quicker in London and Paris and Australia, or all over the world. Just because they're similar and they're confronted with a similar problem, there's a kind of resonance between them. in its most general sense form, this hypothesis says that the so-called laws of nature are more like habits. The universe is not governed by a kind of Napoleonic code of fixed laws that were all there at the very instant of the Big Bang, but rather it's made of evolving habits, and there's a kind of memory in nature. So really, in essence, it's the idea of a kind of memory inherent in nature on which we all draw, and which plays a major role in inheritance. I think a lot of the things we inherit are inherited by morphic resonance, not just in the genes. It also has many implications for spiritual practices, including rituals. When people do rituals in any religion, and even secular rituals like the U.S. Thanksgiving dinner, the fact that people do them in a very similar way to the way they've been done before creates the conditions for morphic resonance. So there's a kind of presence of the past, and the ritual connects people across time, which is exactly what people doing these rituals think is happening. Anyway, that's a brief summary of some of the ideas of morphic resonance.
Now, in regards to, you know, I know you have children and I have a children. In regards to, so one thing you always, you know, I think a lot about is like this nature versus nurture thing, right? And then this morphic resonance theory is interesting to me because it makes me wonder, like, where does that, how do you, does that have any effect on this nature versus nurture thing? I mean, do you think that...
Oh, yes. Definitely has a huge effect on that debate. I mean, the nature versus nurture debate is usually cast in, is it the environment or is it genes? Genes being nature, the environment being nurture. One or the other, or both. And the main evidence for this comes from studies of identical twins who were separated soon after birth. And it turns out that in many studies, and especially the Minnesota Twin Study Program, which is the biggest in the world, the twins that are separated soon after birth have different upbringings. They're adopted by different families, often very different families, and they're studied later to see whether how similar they are. The idea is if they're very similar, then it proves it's in the genes. If they're very different, it proves it's to do with the environment in which they're raised. Well, it turns out that they're often very similar. They have similar diseases at similar stages in their life. They sometimes have similar hobbies. Sometimes they even call their kids by the same names, things that people would not normally expect to be in the genes. The result of these similarities in identical twin studies is that people say, oh, well, it just proves it's all in the genes. And the whole selfish gene theory and sociobiology theory are built on the foundations of these identical twin studies that suggest it's mainly genes, genetic. Everyone agrees there's some environmental influence, but the principal emphasis is on genes. Well, if morphic resonance is taking place, then twins separated soon after birth, because they're similar, precisely because they're similar as identical twins, they'd be in resonance with each other. So something that one of them learned would be picked up by the other. And the similarities in their lives could, in fact, be primarily to do with morphic resonance rather than to do with genes. This is supported by the fact that as a result of the Human Genome Project, when people thought that at first there'd be 100,000 genes, it turns out it's only about 22,000, people thought they'd be able to predict everything on the basis of genes, or almost everything, like proneness to cancer or height or other physical characteristics. It turns out that except for a few rare genetic diseases caused by a single gene, like cystic fibrosis or sickle cell anemia, it turns out that for most inherited features, the genes only account for about 10% of the inheritance. And the remaining 70 or 80% of the inheritance is not accounted for by the genes. And this is now called the missing heritability problem. And it's a very big crisis within institutional science. I think a lot of this missing heritability is actually inherited by morphic resonance, not by genes. All genes do is enable us to make the right sequence of amino acids in proteins or regulate protein synthesis. They don't code for instinctive behavior or the shape of your face or anything like that. I think these things are inherited through morphic resonance, a kind of collective memory.
So I know that with like epigenetics and stuff, how you know, the mice experiment where they sprayed you know, a scent, and then like two generations down they would shock them when they sprayed the scent, and two generations down when they sprayed the same scent they would panic like they were being shocked. So
yes.
I'm sure are you familiar with that experiment?
Oh, I am, yes. It's called inheriting the fear of fathers.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. And so we know trauma can be given down through generations. Now, do you think with morphic resonance, do you think it's specific type of things that type of memory that is more connected? Is it something like something maybe the mice learn, or is trauma also shared with other mice?
Well, I think it's that they learn. They what those experiments involved. Them smelling a particular smell, acetophenone was the name of the chemical, and then they got electric shocks. And so the male mice that were trained soon developed an aversion to this smell because it signaled an electric shock. And then, as you said, their children and their grandchildren had the same aversion. No one knows how that's inherited. It's epigenetic, which just means it's not genetic. Whether or not it involves changes in proteins that bind to DNA, or whether it involves an element of morphic resonance, is an open question. But morphic resonance is not just about inheriting traumas, but inheriting forms and instincts and forms of learning. It's really about inheriting anything that's part of a self-organizing system. And I don't think it's just biology. Morphic resonance applies in chemistry as well. If you make a new kind of crystal for the first time, that same substance should crystallize more easily as a result. The more often you make it, the easier it should get. And there's already evidence that this actually happens. This, by the way, I summarize in my main theoretical book, The Presence of the Past. I discuss the missing heritability problem and these problems with the normal genetic dogmatism in my book, Science Set Free.
Yeah, this is a thing. Anytime I love people like yourself who are willing to discuss these, I guess, controversial topics, and they're not controversial, because I think they're interesting, and I think that, but it's amazing, you know, obviously people who might not be familiar with your TED talk that was somewhat you know, banned, and then you've also had some pushback with other people in the science world, but it's amazing how, you know, the similarity between science and religion, you know, the dogmas, you join a group, you become this tribal, you become this tribal person that kind of defends your group at all costs, and you think you're open-minded and your group's open-minded and willing to look at all the, go down any road and look at all the options and look at things from every perspective, but you become just as closed-minded as people on the other side. And I think it seems like every, you know, I had a science communicator on once, and I remember asking her, I'm like, do you think that there'll be any like amazing discovery in the next 100 years or 200 years or in the near future where we're going to look at the way we look at reality today and be like, holy crap, we were all wrong. Like, we were idiots. Because, you know, you can look back in generations and you can look at like our primitive ancestors and be like, you know, what they thought was reality, or the way they looked at reality, like they didn't have it figured out at all. And then, you know, you had, you know, the Greeks who thought that every unexplained thing was because it was a Greek god, you know, there's a god of thunder, a god of water, you know. So we think we progress and we think now we have things figured out. And it's like every generation thinks that, like, oh no, now we have the answers. Now we're closer to figuring everything out. But we could mm-hmm. also be just as far away from the truth as they were, you know? So it's amazing how ignorant we are to that, how people, we always assume like this generation, we're the most intelligent, we have the most figured out. We might have more figured out than the people before us, but we don't have it figured out. And as new evidence comes, I mean, there's so much that we still don't understand. And that's why I love things like morphic resonance and all these just unexplained things. And science has gotten so many things wrong and as throughout their history that it's amazing that every time they have this new theory, they think like, okay, we have, like, this is correct. And I know you've talked about like the speed of light, you know, just and I didn't know this either until I heard it in the interview about how the speed of light has actually changed. You know, like, that's crazy to me, like, to think that, like, oh, we're just going to keep changing what the speed of light is because we can't explain how it's changing. And mm-hmm. you think like, oh no, the speed of light is like, there's they know what the speed of light is, that it's never changed, and it's scientifically proven that, you know, but people forget, like, science is just made up of theories, you know, they're theories, and most things, if not all things, can't 100% be proven to be 100% true, right?
No, well, I mean, the in a way, science is, I think, is more dogmatic than religion, actually, because if you're anyone in any religion knows that there are lots of other religions. I mean, if you're, say, you're a Presbyterian, you know there are Methodists, and you know there are Baptists, and Catholics, and Anglicans, and so on. If you're a Muslim, you know there's Sunnis and Shias. If you're a Buddhist, you know there's Tibetan-type Buddhism, Sri Lanka-type Buddhism, all different. And there's all these different religions. So there's a huge range of choice in religion, a tremendous pluralism. But in science, it's based on the idea that there's only one truth at any given time. So it's much more totalitarian and dogmatic in that sense. You know, if you don't like the Methodists, you can go to the Catholics or you can become a Buddhist. But if you don't like institutional science, you've got nowhere else to go because that's the only show in town. So I think that more pluralism would be a very good thing in science. But the trouble is that the dogmatic defenders of the materialist orthodoxy, which is the dominant one, control the educational system and have a huge influence on the media. I mean, I'm very pleased the internet's here because it has opened up a greater freedom of discussion than there was before. I myself do research on what I call the mysteries of everyday life. There are a lot of things that science actually can't explain, and most science, or at least dogmatic materialists, actually deny. One of them is the feeling of being stared at, the sense of being stared at. 90% of the population, more than 90%, have had the experience of turning around, finding someone's looking at them, or looking at someone and making them turn around. And the dogmatic materialists say, oh, it's just illusion, it's just coincidence, there's nothing to it, it's just superstition. But if you actually do the experiments, and which I've done lots of, and so have other people, there's now a lot of evidence that the sense of being stared at is real. People really can tell in tests above trance levels. It even works through closed circuit television, and animals can feel it too. Here's a phenomenon which everyone knows about, it's part of everyday common sense, and yet the minute you step into the world of institutional science, you encounter a culture of denial, defended by people who call themselves skeptics, but are usually just dogmatists or deniers, and often get extremely angry if you say, look, there's evidence for this, and here's the evidence. Same goes for telepathy. I do research on telephone telepathy, the experience many people have of thinking of someone who then calls. Again, they say it's just coincidence. Well, there's lots of experiments that we've done that show it's not. In our experiments, the subject has four potential callers. We pick one of them at random. They don't know which of the four people is calling. When the phone rings, they have to guess who it is before they look at the caller ID or pick it up and answer it. And the chance level would be 25%, 1 in 4, and the actual scores in these experiments are pretty well at 50%, hugely significantly above chance. So there's lots of evidence for these things, But it's actually quite a good litmus test. If, you know, when you bring these subjects up in conversation with family and friends, and people who are listening to this could try it, you know, bring up a subject of the sense of being stared at, or telephone telepathy, or dogs that know when their owners are coming home, another subject I've done research on. And most people will say, oh yeah, that happens to me, and they'll tell stories about this happening. But there'll often be somebody present who's a dogmatic skeptic, and they get really angry, and they say, this is just superstition, it's all been discredited, it doesn't exist, it's woo-woo, etc. It's a quite a good litmus test, and many of these so-called skeptics haven't looked at the evidence. In fact, they're not interested in the evidence. They think they know the truth. They have a kind of inhabit a kind of dogmatically certain world. And I think this is a serious problem for science. It holds the sciences back. That's why my book, Science Set Free, is called Science Set Free, because I think if we question these dogmas, treat them as scientific hypotheses that need evidence and look at the evidence, then science opens up in a whole new way and all sorts of new inquiries become possible.
Do you think, I've had Dennis McKenna on, and I know you're friends with Terrence when he was alive, and you guys spent a lot of time talking and whatnot, and it seems like there's this link between people who are willing to look at things outside the box and question the status quo and go down every avenue and you know, just question things and be more curious and open-minded, and a link between that, and it seems like there's a lot of people who have messed around with psychedelic drugs and kind of taking that journey with consciousness. And do you think that was a big help with yourself, you know, just experimenting with stuff like that? And I mean, I've heard even Joe Rogan, who's very much considers himself an atheist, you know, talk about how when he did DMT, how he just said that there's, you know, you do DMT and you start reanalyzing your perspective on being atheist. You start reevaluating your opinions on, you know, if there's a higher power or not, because it's that profound of an experience.
Well, yes. I mean, I first took psychedelic in years and years ago, 1970, when I was in Cambridge, LSD. And it had a huge effect on opening up my view of the nature of the mind. You know, before that, I thought the mind was just a series of mechanisms that operated in the brain that enabled you to see the environment and process data logically according to kind of algorithms and stuff. Taking the LSD showed me that there's this vast realms of the imagination, that the power of the mind to create forms and structures, and it gave me a completely different perspective, and also a sense that my own mind is connected with other minds. It's not just inside my head. That there's, as Terence McKenna once said, when you encounter beings in psychedelic journeys or the kinds of things you experience, you realize they're made of mind, but not of my mind. And there's a sense in which our minds expand through these psychedelics and become aware of the fact that our own consciousness is linked to other forms of consciousness, including, in the case of DMT, a much higher form of consciousness than our own, a much greater and more inclusive one. So I think that these experiences are telling us something about the nature of minds. And, you know, like spiritual experiences are telling us, many spiritual experiences result in kind of mystic type experiences of unity with a greater consciousness. And I think psychedelics can do that too. I'm particularly interested in Michael Pollan's recent book, How to Change Your Mind. Because he started off as a kind of atheist and materialist, and then he took a number of psychedelics, and he ends the book by saying, you know, he now realizes that mind's distributed much more democratically in nature. He thought before it was a kind of bubble inside the brain, now sees that the natural world is much more alive, and there's much more mind and consciousness in the world around us than he'd assumed beforehand. So I think psychedelics are probably one of the most important ways in the modern world in which people have a kind of rite of passage into a more inclusive view of reality, away from the narrow mechanistic materialism that's still orthodox in science and in the educational system.
Yeah, and I think it's not a coincidence that a lot of these atheists, they have two things in common, is that, and I consider myself, you know, agnostic or atheist. I don't like using the terms because I feel like I left one group to just join another group, and so I don't like using labels because I'm like, I'm not sure. And atheists criticize religious people because they're like, well, you can't be sure. How can you be so sure of this? But yet they do the same thing of being very sure that nothing exists. And I lie somewhere in the middle where I'm just not sure. So I'm just going to say, I don't know. I don't know either way. But it seems like a lot of these atheists, one, either they were raised super religious and they rebelled against it. And it's almost like there's this dislike or this hatred towards, you know, being lied to when they were a child or feeling like they were lied to, and that's why they went to the other extreme. And two, it seems like many of them haven't done any psychedelics to, or, you know, anything like that to expand their consciousness and kind of, I guess, maybe help them understand that there's more than just the material world. And do you think that it's a coincidence that those two things seem to be common with a lot of people who are dark dogmatic when it comes down to being atheist and very just, you know, modern science driven?
Well, I think, you know, there's various kinds of atheists. I mean, most of the ones that, who belong to these skeptic organizations and in militant atheist groups are seem to have a very narrow range of experience, and many of them seem to be very angry. Even if they've not personally had negative experiences of religion. I mean, Richard Dawkins, for example, is very angry. But I don't think he had any particularly bad experiences. He's not talked about them, if so. And so there's a kind of anger in it, which is very, very negative. These militant skeptic organizations, too, they often seem very angry. But there are atheists who are more reasonable and who are not militant and who just don't think there's a creator God, but some of them think there is a much greater consciousness in the universe. And then it really comes down to a question of what you call things. I mean, I myself think that when one has an experience of being part of a greater consciousness through meditation, for example, or through some of the other spiritual practices I discuss in my book, Science and Spiritual Practices, or through psychedelics, then how do we know that that experience of a greater consciousness is not simply what it seems to be, a greater consciousness that we can contact through our own consciousness? The main argument against it is theoretical, the materialist belief that the mind is nothing but the activity of the brain and that nature is made up of unconscious matter. But that's a belief system, and it's not a very good one when it comes to explaining consciousness, because materialists don't really have a theory of consciousness. That's why the very existence of human consciousness is called the hard problem in the philosophy of mind. So I think that if one just trusts one's own experience rather than the theory that has no theory of consciousness in it, that's become extremely dogmatic and limited, then the experience of being connected to a greater consciousness than one's own is probably because there is a greater consciousness than one's own to which one's connected. Then it's a question of what do you want to call it. You could say, well, it's nature. It's not God, it's just nature. You could say it's God. You could say it's, you could just leave it open and say it's a greater consciousness or a supreme power or something like that. So then atheists who have these experiences and who acknowledge them then differ from religious people really in saying, well, I don't believe that God as you've defined God, but I do believe there's a greater consciousness which I can directly experience. Then, as I say, it becomes really a question about what you call things, not really about whether there's a greater consciousness or not. What all religions have in common is that they all believe there's a consciousness greater than our own. What materialists have in common is that they believe that there isn't. They believe that our experiences are nothing but the activity of our brains, and they're all confined to the inside of our heads. And that sets materialists apart from all the world's religious traditions, including shamanic traditions, all of which acknowledge forms of consciousness greater than our own. And I do myself. I think that it's my own experience convinces me that there really are forms of consciousness greater than our own. They're not an illusion. They're not a superstitious belief system. They're a matter of experience. And all religions basically start from experience, not from theory. Like the Buddha didn't start Buddhism because he did a PhD and spent years studying in libraries. He was enlightened by meditating, sitting under a tree. And all religions start off from a direct experience. So I think that experience is central in this, which is why spiritual practices have such an important role to play.
Yeah, I mean, and you see things like yoga and exercising, they do more for somebody who's dealing with depression and anxiety than any pharmaceutical drug. You see tons of studies with, you know, how exercise can actually help with depression and anxiety and all these issues. And I think that's the reason why you see this increase in maybe going to the gym, yoga, people riding their bikes more and all this stuff. And you hear about people walking on grass barefooted. And I think there's just this connection to, I think we live in a very unnatural, unhealthy life with how fast paced we constantly are going, and we never have any time to like just sit back and reflect and think and reanalyze and just be one with our thoughts. And that's where, you know, I know you have a chapter on singing, chanting, and the power of music. And you know, I'm a musician. I'm a huge fan of music. You know, I believe that if it wasn't for music, who knows? I mean, I dealt with some serious depression growing up, and music really was my therapy, and it helped me in just ways I can't even put into words. And it's I think there's a lot of people who have similar stories who go through some very tough times in life, and music's the only thing that helps them get through it. And I think the arts that are usually the first thing that gets cut in schools, you know, the art class, the music class, all that stuff, I think it's incredibly important for kids to do those type of things, to tap into their imagination, tap into critical thinking skills, but more importantly, just that sense of meditation. Because when you're working on, when you're playing the guitar or you're playing the keyboard, piano, and you get in this trance state where you're just kind of going wherever the music is going. I remember my brother and I would get together with different friends and we would jam. You know, we just kind of, somebody would start playing some beat or rhythm or notes, and we would just follow them. And you just go wherever the music took you, and you would almost get in this trance where you just kind of just go, and you almost feel like you're it's not you, you're almost being taken on this journey, and like you're more like a passenger than you are the driver. And it was just this amazing sense of therapy. You know, you just felt like all these emotions were coming out during this performance, while you're playing this music. It was just like you're, and you know, you hear people say that all the time, you know, about a great guitarist, like, oh, he's playing his heart out. You know, it's almost like if you took how you felt and you could put it into music, that's what you're doing with the guitar or the piano or whatnot. And when I was playing in a band with my brother, that's what we would do. I always try to say, like, try to play the way you feel. And when you did, there's this sense like you almost felt like you got, without going to a therapist and verbally getting something off your chest, you felt like you did it musically. And I think it's so important for people to have that. And, you know, and I know your wife does chanting, right?
Yes, Jill Peirce, my wife, teaches chanting and meditation. And that's one of the inspirations for my book, Science and Spiritual Practices, because what she does is teaches the basic principles of, you know, breathing and chanting and the voice. And some of the people who come to her workshops say that they've never been able to sing or they can't sing. And her point is everyone can. And chants are simpler than songs, so it's much more empowering for people to do these simpler tunes with repetitive words or simply just a mantra. And what I've seen at her workshops over the years is that all sorts of people come to them. Some of them are regular religious practitioners, some of them are atheists, some are agnostics. They're people from all different backgrounds. And yet everyone can benefit from this, and chanting together is a powerfully bonding experience. And so people have a really good time at these workshops and are re-empowered with their voice. But it's not about beliefs, it's about the experience. And that's why I wrote this book, because it's seven different kinds of practice: meditation, music, connecting with nature, relating to plants, pilgrimage, gratitude. These are all things that anyone can do. All of them have benefits, and none of them depend on you've got to sign up to this belief system first. You start from the experience, and then that will help you in your understanding, and it will probably lead to a change in your belief system if you've got a very dogmatic one. But starting from practice is the way to go. Talking of my wife, Rick, she's just cooked dinner.
Yes, so yes. I just looked at the time
and wrap up fairly soon. I can then go and join her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I know how important it is, and a happy wife, happy life. So it's but thank you so much, Rupert, for your time. I really, really appreciate it. Like I said, I'm a huge fan. I've been listening to reading your books and listening to your interviews for a long time, and I'm always very happy when I see your name pop up on some of the podcasts I listen to throughout the years. And I think it's so important to have people like yourself who, because like you said, and you talk about it in your book, Science and Spiritual Practices, how, kind of growing up, it was just typical that if you got into science, you were an atheist, and I think that when you do that, you kind of lose some of the things that are, spirituality and religion can be helpful with. And so a lot of my religious friends, even I have Muslims, Catholics, Christian friends, and one thing that they seem to really hold on to that I think people who aren't religious don't hold on to quite as well is family, community, the fact that there's things that are more important than these material things. And I think if you can use religion to help you put those things in perspective, you'll be a much happier person. And there's a very interesting debate between Dan Carlin and Sam Harris, which a lot of people aren't familiar with because it kind of didn't get a lot of attention. But it's an old conversation they had, and they got in a debate. And Dan Carlin's a history podcaster. He has a hardcore history. And they got in a similar debate where Sam Harris blames everything on religion, and religion's the root of all, all this violence and horror throughout history. And Dan Carlin, from history perspective, really puts in words how you can look at history and how you can use nationalism and all these other things. And so I think that, those type of perspectives are important to realize that things are much more complicated than sometimes they seem. It's not as not every thing is either good or bad. It's what you do with it. So
absolutely, yes.
So I won't make your wife any more angry than she probably is, because I'm holding you up. But thank you so much, Rupert. I really appreciate it. Have a
pleasure, Rick. And keep up the good work.
Yeah, thanks for your time. Hopefully we'll speak again in the near future.
I hope so.
Hey, take care, Rupert.
Bye for now.
Yep.
Bye.
I believe in the ripple effect.